Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Doing okay, man.
So tonight's topic, we jump up north to Canada. It's very interesting. I'd actually never heard of this case before we started researching it. So I was pretty excited once I found out about it. So what are we doing tonight, Aaron?
Well, tonight is the highly charged, very controversial case of the murder of Lynn Harper. And we'll also be discussing the accused and later convicted, Stephen Truscott.
This is kind of an old case, but Stephen's still alive today. When did this go down?
This went down in 1959. And it basically comes down to Stephen was asked to give Lynn a ride. She had asked for a ride. She had gotten into what they say is a fight or an argument with her parents. She had gone to her guide meeting or brownie meeting, and then sometime around 7:30, she asks Stephen Truscott for a ride so she can go see some ponies. There are some ponies that are down the highway that she can go visit, and she likes to go visit those ponies. Yeah, it's a mile and a half or just a little over that probably to see the ponies, and he says that, you know, sure. And so she gets on the crossbars of his bike, and supposedly they go down gravel road and to Highway 8, where he says she wants off, that she's just going to head on, you know, by herself to go see the ponies.
It's kind of an intersection in the road right there to the highway.
So she chooses to hitchhike basically that distance because he starts to head back. But when he stops on the bridge, he looks back and he sees her getting into a car, which he says is a gray 1959 Chevrolet Bel Air with a yellow license plate or bumper sticker.
Yeah.
And he actually makes note, he says, of the license plate number, which at the time, this comes out later, but he says it's 981666.
It's interesting because it was sort of far away. So they question whether he could have seen the license plate from that distance.
So we can get into what has been argued from both sides on this case because she ends up being found a couple of days later in a place known as Lawson's Bush.
And when they find her, she's been brutally raped and strangled to death.
She's strangled with her blouse. And she has an undershirt, which is the only thing she's wearing at this point. It's bloody. And then the rest of her clothes seem to be neatly set aside. And she has a necklace that's hanging from the fence.
And this bush is pretty much on the way to the drop-off point where he claims he dropped her off. It's like halfway there.
Yeah, there's a point at which, depending on if he's taking her to this spot or to the highway, where he'd have to go a different way. There's a little tractor trail that's off a road that would lead down to this bush area, or he could continue on and go over the bridge and go to the highway. And that will be important because there are different witnesses that have different takes on where they saw him and if they saw him and with who. Mm-hmm.
So he takes her. He comes back. That night, she doesn't return home. They report her missing. And 2 days later, they find her body. The next day, he's taken into custody, Stephen is, and taken in for interrogation. And they say that they interrogated him for 7 or 8 hours, and he's 14 years old. Which, were his parents there? Was a lawyer there? Probably not. I take issue with that because I realize it's a murder. It's a heinous murder. But interrogating a 14-year-old boy, trying to get him to tell you what happened, is sort of questionable in my mind. But I get the passion there of, you know, we need to find who did this to this little girl because this is a heinous crime. That's where it starts, is with his interrogation.
Well, another thing to keep in mind is a 14-year-old isn't necessarily a 5-year-old. A 14-year-old is a young adult, basically.
Well, then let's let them vote and drink.
No, you have to understand, a 14-year-old, while they may not be able to smoke and drink legally, they have still been quite capable of killing people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's 130 pounds. Mm-hmm. Which is he was capable of doing damage to a 12-year-old girl.
Yeah, he's way bigger than Lynn.
And he didn't have any trouble giving her a ride down the road on his bike.
No, no. And if you see pictures of him, he's kind of tall, and he's a big 14-year-old. So they charge him with first-degree murder within 2 days of the crime?
Yeah, the crime happens on June 9th, and he's charged on June 13th at 2:30 in the morning.
Okay.
But it should be said, he did not confess at all to this, and he didn't implicate himself in any way that I could find that would, you know, that would point out that maybe he was having doubts about himself or that, that he was breaking or anything like that. It's pretty obvious that the reason they picked him up is because enough witnesses said, yeah, the last time we saw her, she was riding on the crossbars of his bike.
He definitely was the last person seen with Lynn. There's no doubt about it, and he should be considered suspect number one in that case, definitely.
So the interesting thing here is 3 days after the incident, he is examined, and he has some injuries to his elbows and to his chest, and then he has 2 lesions, one on each side of his penis. And I believe that this is probably something that really focused the attention of law enforcement on him and said, gee, last person seen with her, he does have some injuries, including to his groin. Perhaps we should really move on this guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the police report, the sheriff or whoever said, it looks like Lynn was fighting back, so we should find somebody that has wounds or scrapes or something. So whether or not his wounds and scrapes match defensive wounds or offensive wounds for that matter, that's up for debate, but that was in the police report. So they go on to charge him and they go to court. And that's when we get into the pretty much the eyewitness testimony, right?
They have disagreements over where he should be taken to court.
Because he's 14.
Well, it's not just that he's 14. It has to do with the kind of case that it is. It's a pretty serious case.
Yeah.
And so the Crown Attorney and defense counsel are working this out. That's putting it mildly. They're trying to figure out where to take this case. They decide that he should stand trial basically in an adult court as an adult.
Which, for the heinous crime, I get that. I get that decision. I mean, if he robbed somebody or stole a car, no. But when you're being charged with rape and murder, that's a different situation. So I get their decision there.
And they hold a hearing and they're just trying to find out if there's enough evidence to really go ahead with the trial. And at these pre-trial hearings, it's essentially like a small trial. They have witnesses come forward, bringing forth evidence, and then the magistrate can decide whether it's going to be a full-blown trial or not. And of course, there is a lot of evidence here, and there are plenty of witnesses, although most of them are pretty young.
Yeah, which is kind of an issue. I mean, you gotta have witnesses to find out what happened, but all the witnesses are teenagers and younger, so stories are going to be a little nonlinear, and times and details are going to be a little vague.
They are very, I mean, a lot of these, when I was reading through the statements by some of these different witnesses, a lot of them are 11 or 12 or 13. And that's because these are the kids that would hang out with each other. But yeah. Right from the beginning, you read this stuff and you think, wow, this is going to be really difficult unless they have, as we like to say, a smoking gun. Going off of these witnesses, it can be very, very difficult.
So the evidence, I mean, really, if you just glance at this case, you can be like, he's the last guy seen with this girl. She ends up dead the next day. Case closed. I mean, there's not much to it.
Oh, there's more to it than that, though.
You know, but I mean, if you just looked at a glance, people could, you know, just be like, yeah, oh, I don't care what he says. He's the last person seen with her, and she's literally killed right after he's not seen with her. So it goes a little bit further than that. And that's, I think some of the evidence gets a little jumbled in the court, in the trial. So what should we start with?
All of the evidence, all the witness testimony can all be taken one way or the other. There is nothing here that absolutely points to a definite. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that right now because I've read through the transcripts and read through the testimony, and you want to talk about, this is why this case was so controversial, and you'll talk to people and they'll say, oh, he's definitely guilty, or he didn't do it. So let's kind of go through some of this stuff.
Okay.
One of the early determinations that had to be made was her stomach contents, because she had eaten probably not too long before she went out. So they could actually use that to determine, probably since it took them a couple of days to find her or to come across her, it may help them figure out about when she died. But back then, they couldn't say, oh, it was this 30-minute period here. It's not an exact science. And when you're dealing with someone who was last seen with her, who was out kind of late, it kind of gets around dark, then it gets difficult, because if she was killed that evening, then it may be him or it may not be him, but it keeps him in the possible zone. We'll put it that way. Where she was, Lawson's Bush, there's a tractor trail that goes off the road. And one of the first things it's actually probably not one of the first things people will find when they read on this case, but there was a bike track that went all the way through down that way along the tractor trail. And this is where some controversy starts right from the get-go, because the police officers supposedly discussed this, and it seemed obvious that the bike track had been left at a time when the ground was wet, because of the way the impression was. Very defined. I've seen this bike track on the internet, and it's very defined. It definitely looks like it was left at a time when the ground had been wet, which would rule it out from being relevant to this case. And there was also talk that there may have been tire tracks in the area. And the man who owned the property said he saw a strange vehicle there, although I didn't see anything that showed whether he actually got a good look at the vehicle or not. He just said that there was a vehicle there that he didn't recognize, not necessarily right there, but on his property.
So let's go back to the time of death and the contents of her stomach. The autopsy, what was the doctor's name?
Dr. Peniston.
Peniston. There's lots of different ways to find time of death. And he says, well, how far along the food in her stomach was digested will tell us, because that's the last time she ate, blah, blah, blah. And if I remember right, he pretty much puts it right at the time she was last seen with Steven. But then essentially he came up with that by just looking at some stomach contents in a jar. And then later on, he kind of recants that. He says, well, it was more of a window of time. So if he's saying in court one thing, but then generalizing later, I don't really like that. I don't think in 1959 they could pinpoint down to a very specific time at that point. And he sort of does that. And I feel like he does that for the prosecution because it's such a charged case.
Yeah, I think this happens a lot, actually. I think
they
have meetings with their witnesses, and this is just a guess, but I wouldn't be surprised if he had told them it could have been between 7 or 9 o'clock. And I'm sure they said, well, we kind of need it to be before 8. And he'll say, well, I don't know. And they may have said, look, I mean, is this really possible? Sure, it's possible. Okay, well, we need you to say that then. Because it's not a lie. It's just a omission. They can talk him through it and convince him that it's okay. But later, if he's questioned again, I'm sure it comes out that, well, it's not that exact a science.
No. So I take a little bit of a problem with that. The tracks on the trail, these kids are hanging out there. So I didn't put a lot of weight to those either. But the fact that one was an impression when it was wet, you're saying that pretty much excludes his bike. Well, that makes sense. So,
well, I would say what it does, it excludes that track from being relevant, but it's not saying that he didn't take his bike down there, or there's any number of ways this could have gone down where he wouldn't have left marks. I mean, it wasn't wet.
Yeah, exactly.
And he may not have taken his bike all the way over there.
Mm-hmm.
There's also there were also some footprints, shoe prints, I should say, by the body. And this is actually one of the, I would say the most frustrating part of the case for me are the shoes, because it seemed like they sort of dropped the ball in this area, because the shoe prints, they found his shoes, they looked at the tread of the shoes, and they looked at the tread near the body. They don't seem to make a big deal of this, but they say, wow, these look really similar.
Yeah.
But why weren't they taking measurements? I mean, did you get the feeling that they took measurements?
Not at all.
It seemed to me that they just looked at the tread. Well, great. You know, but that's, if they were the same size footprint, shoe print, then maybe you've got him nailed. Maybe this is enough to really persuade people, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in this is 1959. We don't have DNA. You know, they barely have fingerprints and other things. So they have a shoe print. Let's go with that. You know, I mean, that's some hard evidence right there. And for them to not really analyze that, not even really use it so much in court, is bothersome.
Nowadays, they would have taken those shoes in. They would have tried to match the size. They would have tried to match the tread exactly. They would have examined the shoes, because as far as I remember, they didn't look like they had been cleaned. So they could have tried to match the specific ground that was by her with whatever was on the shoes, be it grass or dirt.
I mean, they could have made a plaster cast of it. You know, a lot of things they could have done.
So that for me was a very frustrating point reading through this case. Another thing is the physical examination of him. And this comes up in court because essentially they say there are four pillars holding the case up. And one of these has to do with the condition of Stephen Truscott as he was examined, because it seemed very strange that he would have injuries to himself given what had just occurred, and given that he was suspected of possibly being involved or being the sole perpetrator in this crime.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
So what I saw here was during the case, during the actual trial, they brought in these doctors to really emphasize that he would not have injuries to his groin area if he wasn't perpetrating a heinous sexual attack. But at the same time, I hear that when he goes to a jail and they examine him there, that the jailhouse doctor says that his marks look like normal marks, and the marks on his groin look like dry skin or some sort of skin condition and nothing to do with wounds. In trial, you have doctors saying these look like wounds, you know, from doing something rough, as opposed to a doctor saying this is just a skin condition, or maybe he hasn't bathed in a while. So there's a little bit of controversy there.
Well, as far as I know, the condition of his genitals were a little different. And that's because, well, let's put it this way. Dr. Charles Danby is the one that mm-hmm. was the doctor who says that he had treated him on 6 previous instances for a skin mm-hmm. condition, say dermatitis, and that they yeah. were on his face and on his back. And this is strange because he has this condition that causes oozing, scaling, and crusted spots on himself, you know, on his skin.
Yeah.
And these are sort of what's described on his penis.
Yeah.
But it's just odd that they're on one on each side of it. And that's where there were two other doctors at trial saying that it was likely caused by friction. So that each side, because if for the sake of argument, if he's assaulting the girl and there's going to be friction, most likely in this case,
yeah,
that it would cause him to get raw. And that would be the reason why he has these lesions. But Dr. Charles Danby says, well, I would say this is more of his dermatitis. And when they ask him about it, he explains it away in an intelligent manner by saying that it's quite possible that he's had this issue, but didn't bring it up because it's on his genitals.
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
It could be embarrassing. He doesn't want to tell people about it. Mm-hmm. So even if he was being treated, my only thing here is if he does have a skin condition, did the doctor never bring up to maybe examine him further to see how bad bad this was? Did he only have him take off his shirt at these visits?
Who knows? I mean, right now it could have been either a skin condition or it could have been from an attack. And I see both sides of that one. I don't know where I fall on that, but I definitely see both sides because either one makes sense.
You've seen, I know this isn't exact evidence, but you've seen pictures of him, right? From back then?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does he look like he's got a bad condition?
No, he actually looked like a pretty boy, like real clean cut, nothing on his face, nothing on his hands. So,
okay. Like I said, it's not proof, but in all the pictures I've seen him, he looks like he has pretty good skin.
Yeah.
Especially for a 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, they didn't have the processed foods we have now.
Well, I'm just saying if he did have a condition that was so bad that he had gone to the doctor 6 times previously.
Yeah.
I just find that interesting. That's all.
All right.
We should talk about the witnesses because the witnesses are a major factor in the case. And trust me, I tried to find a way to really minimize this part of the case because we're talking about young kids. And just reading through the things they said, I really got the feeling that they're really young kids. And that
I know
adults can forget things. They can misinterpret what they're seeing just as well as a kid could. But mm-hmm. I also, to preface this, I got the sense that some of these kids had allegiances. And that cuts both ways. Believe me, it's not to say that this favored or disfavored Truscott necessarily. It's just I got the sense that this was true, that some of these kids had allegiances in this.
Well, popular kids and cliques are not a thing of modern times. So, yeah.
I'm just saying it's a real possibility that this was going on. And of course, there's some statements that might back that up. But which witnesses did you really think were important when you read over this?
Really, there was, what was his name? Butch. Butch is one.
Arnold George.
And there was a little girl, wasn't there?
There was a girl that he was supposed to, she says, and he says that they had talked about going to, I think, look for calves over by Lawson's Bush. And she ended up turning him down or canceling. And this was just prior to the time that he gets asked for a ride, that Lynn Harper asks for a ride. And depending on who you believe, you know, she says that he had said, you know, don't tell anybody that I asked you that, then, you know, just forget about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have Phillips, who says he didn't see them on the road and he was walking down the road, which would mean that they were off in the bush doing something as opposed to, you know, going down the road to the drop off point per se. Butch was kind of in that same boat, right? He was saying that he didn't see them cross the bridge or he didn't see them go all the way down to the highway. And I think Butch even says they were in the bush or he saw them go to the bush. So we have two essentially witnesses that are saying, no, they stopped or we didn't see them, meaning they would be in the bush. And then you have the girl that's kind of saying, no, not so much. And then finally we have Doug, who says he saw them cross the bridge and go past the bush and go on. So Doug and the girl are kind of back up Stephen's story, whereas the other two are saying that doesn't make sense. Now, they discredit Doug's account because they say where Doug was, he wouldn't have been able to see them go across the bridge. Yet where Doug says he was, if you go there, you can see. There is a line of sight. But essentially his testimony, I felt, was thrown out in court because they just said you couldn't have seen what you saw. Meanwhile, Butch kind of got the timing wrong and kind of changed his story. Now, whether or not that was totally disregarded in court, I can't, you know, I don't know how the jury's felt about that, but I think Butch's testimony was pretty damning, regardless of whether he got the time wrong. What did you think about him?
Which one?
Butch.
Are you talking about Arnold George?
Arnold. Yeah, Arnold.
Arnold's an interesting witness here because he's the one that says at first he seems to support Stephen's story. And then after the discovery of Lynn, her body, he seems to go back. He says, no, wait a minute. And then says, this is what I saw. And it's different. He changes his story and makes it. He has a damning story, essentially, about seeing Lynn and, or knowing that Lynn and Stephen go into the woods.
So you can take that a couple ways. Either he did get it wrong and he wanted to correct his mistake, or B, he doesn't even know if he got it right or wrong. But now that he knows that the little girl was murdered, he's changing his story because he needs to. It can go one way or the other at this point.
Yeah, his stories are all over the place. One of his stories is that he went to Stephen's house about 8:45 that night. And, you know, Arnold says, where were you? And Stephen says, down at the river. And he says, I heard that you had given Lynn a ride down to the river. And he said, yeah, she wanted to lift down to No. 8 highway. And Arnold says, I heard you were in the bush with her. And he said, no, we were on the side of the bush looking for a cow and calf. Mm-hmm. And he goes, why do you want to know for? And Arnold says, skip it. Let's play ball.
Yeah. And who knows if that conversation took place. And if it did, again, we have Stephen not really implicating himself.
It sort of is because he's claiming that he's looking for a cow and calf, which sort of goes back to the Jocelyn story.
Yeah, and he's placing himself at the bush, but saying he's not in the bush. So
this is where some would say this is a place he likes to go to.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a hangout for a lot of the kids.
Or he in particular, at least. Mm-hmm. And then there's also another witness, and this is George Archibald, and he's 13 mm-hmm. years old, and he gives testimony that he overhears Arnold and Stephen talking. And this is something I find particularly interesting, and here's the conversation. Arnold asked Stephen what he was doing in the woods with Lynn, and Stephen responded, I wasn't in the woods with Lynn, was I? And then Arnold hesitates, and he says, no, I guess it was somebody else. And then George Archibald says that Stephen adds, I was chasing a cow, wasn't I, Butch? Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely, I wasn't in the courtroom, but it almost sounds to me like he's coaching him.
Yeah.
And so
leading him to what he wants him to say.
This is a perfect example of how you can take an element of this case and you can go either way with it. You could say, mm-hmm. no, he's correcting him. Or you could say, no, he's telling him what to say. Like, I'm telling you where I was, even though that's not really what I was doing.
Yeah.
And even one of Stephen's own brother, he has a brother that even says that Stephen was a bit rough and a bit intimidating and that other kids were nervous of him. So it's a possibility anyway.
Yeah.
But it's not, there's no definitive proof here that he was pushing Arnold. Although if he was, it might explain why his story changes so much. And it changes a lot. In fact, it changes so much that people don't really put stock in him. But perhaps all that changing story, there's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. And then the other kid that says he didn't see him along the road. Well, it's possible that he just happened to not be walking along the road at the same time that Stephen and Lynn were taking their ride. I mean, we don't know if they were exactly there at the same time. So for him to say, I didn't see them on the road, that means they're in the bush. It doesn't guarantee that. It just means that he didn't see them when they were riding. So who knows where they were at the time when this other kid was walking down the road. So those are pretty much the few eyewitness accounts that I paid attention to, but at the same time, they're all a little contradictory or can be construed in different ways.
I think one of the reasons for that is you're asking all of these young kids to know what time it is.
Yeah. Half of them probably don't even wear watches.
I have no idea.
Cell phones with Facebook. It's not like they're tweeting, oh, I'm at the bush today.
You know. Yeah, they're going to GPS tag that. Yeah. It's true. There's no... This is, you can already see how difficult this case is just based on, so far we've covered the stomach contents, which that's going to come up later again, but it's so difficult to nail down. 2 hours can make a huge difference. If it was 7:30 or 9:30, that's a pretty big difference, because when we start getting into 9:30, 10 o'clock, now we might be getting to the time where, gee, Stephen's home.
Yeah. People saw Stephen shortly after he dropped off Lynn. So we have witnesses placing him in different places. So, or we have witnesses placing him in very concrete places in a certain time frame. But when he was dropping Lynn off, that's when time seems to go out the window.
We talked about it before, but where he is, where he's seen is important, because it's pretty unlikely if he can be placed at the highway with her, that means he went past where he would need to go to take her to Lawson's Bush.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why it's important if some of these witnesses are right. You know, if you have two witnesses saying, oh, we saw him, and then another witness that's there says, I didn't see him, it gets confusing. Who saw him where? And it's important, because if he takes that tractor trail, he's going one way. If he goes toward the highway, he's going another way. So keep that in mind. Truscott is very, very problematic for himself. And that's because his own statements really put him in a bad spot in this whole case. And it's because you can chalk it up to he's young and dumb, possibly, or that he's being very deceptive and that he chooses not to say things until much later.
Mm-hmm. Which I will fully admit, I fall on the he's young and dumb. I guess just because I saw the way, you know, Damien Eccles responded to the allegations that he killed those boys in the West Memphis 3. And he didn't do himself any favors either. So I kind of fall on that side where a 14-year-old's not going to know what to say, or he's not going to be well-spoken, especially about himself and the time frames of what he was doing that day. But what did he say?
Well, he didn't speak at the trial, but he did have statements that he had given to the police that could be used for him. Mm-hmm. And his defense was, he said he had taken Lynn to the intersection and that she had been picked up, that she had gotten a ride in some strange car.
Now let's talk about that. So essentially he takes her down to the intersection and then he just drops her off. And it's a little weird because the intersection, there's not much around there, and it's what, about halfway to where she's going?
It's way more than halfway. It's almost to where she's going. He takes her most of the distance.
Okay.
I would say she's well over three quarters of the way there.
Yeah.
Okay. She's well on her way to where, and he says she wants off and that she's just going to go the rest of the way by herself, but that can be debated, that someone like her would want to be alone out there by herself.
Was she planning on walking the whole way there? You know?
I don't know.
I mean, that's the thing is, on one side, yeah, she jumped on his bike, rode out there, and then, hey, you can let me off here. Thanks for the ride, guy. See you later. Yeah, so, I mean, it's plausible that she said, okay, this is as far as I want to go.
Let's talk about why that might be. Mm-hmm. Because I was thinking about this, and the only thing I can think of, and I don't know this for a fact, but is it possible that she just was uncomfortable?
It's possible, yeah. He might have said something rude to her. He might, you know, or she might have just been like, oh, my parents don't need to see me with a 14-year-old or, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the age had anything to do with it, but the only thing I could come up with on my own was possibly she was uncomfortable if his story is true.
Saying that she immediately gets into a car, if she's most of the way to her destination, then why would she need to get a ride at that point? You know, she could have walked the rest of the way and been fine. And the distance from where he was dropping her off to where she is getting in the car, he rings off this license plate number, make and model of a car. I don't know if you can see a license plate from that far away. I doubt it, but that's just my opinion.
They did do tests on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little too far away.
They said it was possible. Independently tested, it was possible. I wonder if he could remember days later.
Yeah.
And certainly that's where the possibility comes up, because they actually locate about 5 different vehicles that have similar license plate numbers. Mm-hmm. And the first one that matches his license plate, but not the vehicle description, that one doesn't pan out. They find one that has the first 2 digits transversed. So it's actually 891 instead of 981, mm-hmm. 666. And that person was able to tell them that they weren't there at the time. And there was nothing about them, about that person that alerted investigators at all. So, As someone who gave a statement, they just said that they weren't there at that time.
I mean, if you walked out the front of my house and I was waving goodbye to you on my front porch and you got in a car and took off and you're only 20 feet away from me, I probably wouldn't be looking at the license plate. I probably wouldn't even think twice about it. So I find that whole scenario kind of weird. I'm sure he could see the make and model and the color of the car, but my two biggest things are, I don't think he could see the license plate or remember it. And I don't understand why Lynn would just jump into a car when she's most of the way to her destination.
Right. And that's something I find very fishy as well, is that he would just so happen to know everything about this car, and that she would just happen to get into the car, because that's his testimony. It's not like someone jumped. See, if he had said someone grabbed her, that would be one thing. But if he is making up the story, I think the reason he doesn't come up with that is because he doesn't tell anybody that she gets into a car until much later.
Yeah.
That's not something he doesn't stop and talk to a friend on the way back and say, hey, this is what happened. Because certainly he does talk to friends. He goes home. He doesn't tell anyone there. Her father has to come to the house and start asking.
So his story's not the best.
No, and he's not able to say, and of course we've been over this, how do these kids know what time it is? Yeah. They have approximations based on whatever. Maybe someone has a wristwatch, as you have offered up, but he doesn't know quite when he gets home. And he has a conversation at the house, but his parents have been very supportive of him. At no point have I ever gotten the idea that they ever questioned whether he was involved in this or not. It was basically like a blanket trust. He has conversations regarding his, I guess you could say, classmates, the other kids that were around. And you can tell in his statements that he does zero in on Arnold George, because Arnold George is the one that people keep saying, well, he's the one telling everyone you were in the bush with Lynn. And so, you know, he says that he goes over and he says that Arnold George says, oh, I didn't tell anybody that.
But again, the other guy, Doug, who says that he went on, they throw that out immediately. It's just what they choose to take into trial and what they debunk. Of course, you know, a prosecutor is going to be like, nah, this guy couldn't have seen it, you know, and the defense attorney is going to be like, nah, this guy's story just keeps changing. So it's a mess.
Right. And Truscott even denies that he had any date made to go look for cabs, and he denies calling her, which is odd because it places him, this sort of places him at that spot, at least intentionally, that's where he intended to go. He also has trouble, like he remembers the vehicle, make, model, year, but he cannot remember who he talked to at times. Like he'll deny that he talked to somebody, and that person will say, well, yeah, I saw him over here. And it's as though he can't quite remember some of these conversations he had. And it's
inconsistent.
It's inconsistent. And it seems kind of, it stands out to me that he remembers in much more detail his conversation with Arnold George than someone else that other witnesses place him talking with. That, you know, he denies talking to another kid, and yet you could argue that he's not remembering this conversation because he doesn't want to be placed with that witness. It's difficult to know.
So with this trial, there's a mandatory punishment or a sentence if you're found guilty. What is that sentence, Aaron?
First degree murder, it was automatically a sentence of death by hanging, I believe.
So, yeah, by gallows. Now, this is a heinous crime. It's terrible. But when they chose to try him as an adult, they know that they might be putting a 14-year-old to death. I think that was a mistake. I don't know. I mean, that's just one of those things where I'm like, putting a 14-year-old to death just makes you look bad. Makes the court and the justice system, they got to really dot their I's and, you know, and cross their T's to get this right so they can show this person is a monster and deserves to be put to death if he's found guilty. Yet they're not measuring a boot print. They can't get their witnesses correct. I mean, there's so many problems with the way they're handling it that I go back to, why are they charging him as an adult now?
I think they got caught because the crime was really, really bad. And they had a very decent suspect, not a perfect one, but a very decent suspect. But here's the age issue. Some, like myself, would say perfectly capable of murder. But I bet if you went and took a poll, and this is just, you know, anecdotal thought, whatever. But I think most people have trouble wanting to charge a 14-year-old with first degree murder, especially when it carries the death penalty, because when you say we'll be putting this killer to death and they're 14, I think most people are going to look at that and go, yeah, I have a problem with that.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I do.
And I think
100%.
Yeah. And as we'll find out very soon, this comes back to bite them because this makes this case go well beyond a simple murder and conviction case. This blew up. And the reason it blew up was because of the age. I don't know who could do it, but who's going to put a 14-year-old to death? Even if you can sit here and say he did it, who's going to be able to do that? Who's going to be able to make sure that that sentence is carried out and that he's put to death, especially by hanging? This revolutionized everything in Canada. I mean, this is probably, wouldn't you say, this is what gets them to, they get scared of the death penalty after this.
Yeah, as they should. I mean, you know, here it is. I 100% agree that a 14-year-old is capable of murder. If I was in that little survey, I'd be like, no, a 14-year-old can kill somebody. That's not a thing to me. Yet could I find a 14-year-old guilty knowing that his sentence will be death? I'm going to have a real hard time with that, because as much as I know a 14-year-old is capable of murder, a 14-year-old is not developed. They're going through puberty. Their brain's going through a lot of changes. When I think about when I was 14 years old, I am not the same person. I don't even think the same way. There's nothing about the 14-year-old version of me that could even apply to today. You're dumb when you're 14. You don't know anything when you're 14. So do you deserve another chance if you commit a heinous crime? I don't know. That's up for debate. But putting a 14-year-old to death, to me, it's on the same lines as putting somebody that is mentally disabled to death for something. I'm not saying that all teenagers are, you know, handicapped or mentally challenged, but to me, they're not on the same level. They don't know what they do. They don't know the ramifications of what they do. Probably not a great argument, but that's how I feel about it.
Well, it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction. 14-year-old about to be hung.
Mm-hmm.
So this is later in September 1959, found guilty, sentenced to death. Next year, 1960, the prime minister, I'm sure, is shaking his head going, this is not good.
Yeah.
He commutes the sentence to life in prison.
Which I'm good with that. Because, hey, he committed a crime. Let's punish him. Let's get justice. But putting a 14-year-old to death is pretty harsh, and that's pretty ridiculous. So I understand their change in heart right there.
Right. But already you can see with they had their victory. The prosecutors, mm-hmm. the Crown had their victory in this case. It's starting to slip away. And this is, I'll say it now, if they had just gone through the juvenile system, I don't know that they'd have these problems. I'm not sure this case would have been elevated to where people are arguing on a national level over this, or even around the world.
You're exactly right. You just nailed it on the head.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is, I know that Stephen Truscott may not have had the best life, spending some years in prison. We'll go over that soon. But in a way, I believe it benefited him overall, because it got people on his side that I don't think would have ever known his name had he gone through the juvenile system instead of the adult system.
We wouldn't be talking about him right
may
now.
Not have even known about it.
Yeah.
1967, it gets put before the Supreme Court, and they vote 8-1 against a new trial. Mm-hmm. But there's a dissenting judge. That one guy said he would have ordered a new trial. And here's why. He has three reasons. He said there was highly prejudicial evidence, which we can go over that. We could go over that real quick, which is the lesions on him, the marks on him, the eyewitness testimony that placed him in damning positions, damning spots, so on and so forth.
From the food.
Time of death, right? Improperly admitted evidence, which again goes back to some of that, because was some of this supposed to be admitted? Was it really evidence? That's a question. And then incorrect directions in the judge's charge to the jury. The jury may not have fully understood what they were doing by voting guilty. As you said earlier, can you really find him guilty of first-degree murder if he's going to be put to death?
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. Storyworth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase.
Yeah. And most would tell you, especially anyone in law would say, you have to do what is right. If he's guilty, he's guilty. You can't sit there and second guess the system. But
exactly.
Again, a young guy.
Yeah, but if you know that you're putting someone to death, I would hope that you would require a high level of evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And I know you should find guilt or innocence or guilt or not guilty on the same standard or principle, but we don't. We're human.
1969, Stephen Truscott is released from the penitentiary he's in Kingston, and he's released on parole to live with Malcolm Steinberg, who was the prison chaplain for some years and had recently become a parole officer. So he actually, Stephen goes and lives with him. And if you recall, he was a young guy when he was arrested and convicted. Yeah. And by the time he's 24, 25, he's married. A year later, he marries a woman named Marlene. And Marlene's interesting because she gets involved after reading a book. There's a book written early on here, and it's by Isabel Laborde. And the title of the book is The Trial of Stephen Truscott. And after reading that, she just, her heart went out to him because she felt like he'd gotten a raw deal, that he was innocent of the crime.
It's our first innocent movement kind of that I know about in Canada.
Nowadays, innocence cases are all over the place. There are innocence projects. There are movements on social media to get so-and-so a new trial or get them released. And at this time, I'm not sure a lot of this was going on. Mm-hmm. And again, I think his age played a role, and the fact that they tried him as an adult, that comes up again and again. And he and Marlene would have three children, but she didn't use their name. She supported him, but she also understood the heat on this case, and she used the maiden name of Stephen's mother, which was Bremen.
Yeah.
So they went under the name Bremen for quite a while. And in the year 2000, that's when they come out. And they come out, I think, because they feel it's time to try and clear the air, to try and clear his name. And he says it has to do with the family name because, you know, his parents did support him. And I think he felt like if he didn't do something, that the name would just be blemished. And so in 2000, they come out on CBC's Fifth Estate program. And one thing I should mention before we go on is in 1997, Truscott does something that anybody who believes him to be innocent will probably really focus in on this. And that is that he underwent voluntary DNA testing. He said, test me. They've heard about this DNA testing and how they can compare it to evidence to see if someone was really involved. And he underwent testing, but the evidence in the case was not usable. It was destroyed. And of course, it's not that it was destroyed on purpose. They just, back in 1959, there was no understanding of DNA as evidence in a criminal procedure, criminal trial.
And why would they keep it around if they have their man, he's been found guilty, and he's literally gone to jail and served his sentence? Why would they need to keep the evidence at that point?
Right. It was a victory. Time to move on.
Something else that I read about was while he was in jail for those 10 years that they brought in psychiatrists and whatnot to interview him, try to get into the mind of a killer. And he allowed them to interview him and interrogate him, whatever. And he never confessed to the crime. And they even went so far as to use truth serums on him and rumored that they gave him LSD and questioned him. And at no point did he ever fess up.
That's right. He's never ever said anything even remotely taking any responsibility for the crime that occurred. He never says anything that would give you the idea that he's close to admitting ever. I mean, especially when they are questioning him while he's in the penitentiary. He doesn't say or do anything that would give anyone the idea that he was ever going to do that.
Now, just because somebody never confesses, just because somebody never, you know, does not mean that they're innocent by any means. I think it is a little telling if they're questioning him under truth serums and LSD and whatnot. If that is really true, it's kind of hard to keep a lie at that point. But
well, I'm not sure that stuff was effective. I don't know how they used it or what their expertise was, but I know what you're saying. It could be indicative of his side of the case. In 2001, they file an appeal on his behalf, the lawyers for the Truscotts. 2006, they exhume the body of Lynn Harper. I believe this is tied into the fact that he underwent DNA testing, and this was just a good way to say, look, if we can get DNA from the body and if we could match it or not match it to him, we could really clear this up quickly, because this is already back in the courts. He has a lot more support at this time, way more support than he had back then. I mean, back then, originally in 1959, 1960, he had his family. He had his parents, I should say. And now, in the 2000s, now he has a lot of people supporting him. And he has the support of his wife, Marlene, who, it should be said, really poured over the case. She didn't just accept the fact that he was not guilty of the crime in her eyes. She actually went and read transcripts, and she read through the evidence and statements and really tried to get a real handle on this so that she could communicate to people on it and answer questions, so that she was a strong supporter instead of just a supporter. Mm-hmm. The trouble with exhuming her body was there was nothing usable found. They weren't able to find any DNA to use.
Well, I mean, at the time, they do an autopsy on her, and then they prepare the body for burial. I mean, I'm sure it was cleaned off, and then 50 years later, however many years.
Right. So 2007, his appeal is successful. And that's because, in my opinion, looking through the transcripts from that, they were able to throw into question all of the major evidence and statements that got him convicted in the first place. In other words, yeah, you could say he was over here near the Lawson's Bush, but you could also say he was over here at the highway. In other words, by this time, people were much more understanding that everyone has a different story. And especially if they're, they didn't have DNA to say, oh, we found his DNA on her or in her. That didn't happen. So all of this evidence could have skewed either way. And by highlighting all of that, they went point by point. And most of the evidence that was used against him, they were able to show why you can't just say it's indicative of his guilt. It could actually be indicative of something else, especially like his lesions could have been a skin condition. The crazy thing is, it could have been his skin condition was aggravated by his sexual assault of this young girl. But there's no definitive answer there. You can't just say it was definitely a sexual assault that caused the lesions. They could have just been from his skin condition and he just didn't tell anybody about it. There's no way for anyone to know that. But they go point by point and basically just throw water on everything. Mm-hmm. And they're not wrong. They even, when you read through the transcript, you can see where they're just trying to say the other jury shouldn't have been so sure because we have other witnesses that have him over here. And if he was coming across back across the bridge without Lynn, that shows that he went down to the highway. And if he's without Lynn, then he must have dropped her off. Of course, some might say maybe he left the bush area and went to the highway and then came back. But we don't have witnesses that say he went across the bridge by himself. Mm-hmm. Some witnesses say, oh, I saw him. And some witnesses say, no, I didn't see him over at the bridge. The ones who saw him say they saw Lynn, you know, if he was headed over to the highway. If he's – so it really depends on who you want to believe. But when you bring up this many questions, that's where – that's where people, I think, decided, you know what? We're not so sure of this. And that's how he got his conviction overturned. It's not like they're saying he's not guilty. They're saying, essentially what they're saying here is that he did not get a fair trial.
Yeah. And they could actually recharge him if they wanted to. But how are you going to do that in a case that's this old? You don't have any more witnesses. You don't have any evidence. Any physical evidence, you have nothing. So you are correct. His conviction was overturned, but no prosecutor is going to take this case and retry him ever.
And that's exactly. Where he's going to have difficulty getting that acquittal, which he so desires.
Yeah.
He and his wife have been very clear about that they want to clear the name completely. I would say at this point, he needs to be content with where it is because he was able to at least get his conviction overturned. And as you say, the prosecutor, even if they wanted to do him a favor by letting this go to another trial, no prosecutor in their right mind can do that because, as you say, what are they going to bring forward? Witnesses for a case that's this old? Mm-hmm. And then the evidence is not there anymore? There's just no real way. No feasible way to make this happen.
No.
But they do try to make it up to him, don't they?
A little bit.
A little bit? $6.5 million? I know it doesn't erase. Well, if he's a guy that got shafted on this whole deal, $6.5 million, I'd say that was a pretty good way to let him know that people were sorry. Most people don't see this kind of gift. And I would say if he's not getting an acquittal, this is the next best thing after he gets his conviction overturned.
So regardless of, I mean, seriously, regardless of whether he committed this crime or not, he gets this money. Because they didn't do it correctly the first time. Now, did they not do it correctly because it was a sign of the time, or did they not do it correctly because it was a charged case and a heinous crime, or did they not do it correctly out of sheer incompetence? Who knows?
The one thing I did see that seemed like to me, that he didn't get a fair trial was possible evidence of tire tracks over by the area where she was found. That seemed a bit iffy, especially since supposedly the police were found to have discussed it, but they didn't bring it up. But again, you could argue that it's not really up to the prosecution to offer any help to the defense. But again, this is where I think having it redone in the modern age helped him out a lot. And that's because I think people are more open to really going over the evidence and seeing it in a more objective manner. Whereas back then, I think they had this horrible crime and there were a lot of suspicious things about him. And the trial lasted 15 days. It took 6 hours to find him guilty of the crime and first degree murder. I would say that even back then, you could have looked at the evidence one of two ways and that they just, when they were examining it, the jury decided that he was guilty based on all the suspicious evidence. there were just too many suspicious things going on, and it made it easy for them to go that way. And I would say the same goes for anyone who thinks he's guilty today, that there's a lot of suspicious things going on here.
So where do you fall on it?
I would tend to think that he's guilty. And I would say I can see why the court overturned his conviction, because this evidence does skew one way or another, depending on how you look at it. But I'm highly suspicious of what he was doing and what he says. And the fact that she's left in a spot that he's been known to hang out at, when if she gets in a car, how does her getting in the car end up with her dead in that spot? I think that's, if there was one aspect of this case, forgetting everything else, this is the one thing that really stands out above everything. Mm-hmm. Is the fact that she supposedly gets into a car, which I still can't wrap my head around that. She gets into a car and yet she still ends up dead over at Lawson's Bush. It just does not make sense to me and probably to many others. It just seems just too strange.
No, it doesn't make sense. Why would the person who now has a girl in their car go back to where she was, go back to where other children are? Why not just take off with her? I see that.
So my gut instinct is that he's guilty, and yet I can't prove it. Hmm. But there's certainly a lot of suspicion here.
I think if I would have been on the jury back then, I might have found him guilty, just like the rest of them. Not knowing about the death penalty, I probably would have sided with the guilty verdict, because he's the last person seen with her. This is his known hangout, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But looking at the case now and seeing how he's lived his life, I see patterns. And I really can't believe that somebody at 14 would commit rape and murder, you know, because there's no real evidence that he was murdering people before this or abusing animals, and stop. I just don't think that he would do this, go to jail, get out of jail, and lead a totally, completely normal life. I think if you're capable of that heinous crime, you're not done yet. You're going to keep going and doing other horrible things. I mean, but maybe 10 years in prison changed him. I don't know. I don't know if that reform would have happened. But, you know, there was another suspect, or a suspect that's brought up, not during the trial or anything, but there was another person in the area who, for 10 years before the murder actually takes place, he is, his name's Sergeant Kalachuk, and he's in the Air Force, in the military, and they have files on this guy. And 10 years prior to this murder, it's on record that he exposes himself to little girls. He tries to coax them into his car. He tries to get them into his car using candy and new underwear. He's in the area, yet at no point do they seek him out. They focused on Stephen, as most people would, because he was the last person seen with this child. So, you know, Kalachuk, he's not even on the radar. But if you profile him, he's exactly the type of person that would have done this crime. And he goes on and gets arrested for exposure, arrested for, you know, all kinds of things that, to me, a sexual predator who is capable of this crime would be doing. And Stephen gets out of prison, and to me, he doesn't show any signs of these things. He doesn't go after people. He doesn't have any relapse into his murderous, raping ways. So to me, I have a problem with the whole crime, but at the same time, I have a problem with how could Steve have this one incident in his life and that's it?
It's happened it's before.
It's just not common. That's why I don't think he did this crime, because he is a completely different person now. And if you think he's guilty, then hey, the system worked and he's now reformed.
What does the system do to reform him? There was nothing about the system that worked to reform him at all. If anything, as
we
talked about—
Well, he hasn't killed and murdered anyone. If you engage back in society and you are a normal person now, you're reformed. Is he a functional citizen in society?
Yeah, but you can't— Well, point to what they did to reform him in prison, because I don't see it.
They gave him LSD and kind of tortured him.
You think that's what reformed him?
No, I don't think they reformed him at all. I don't think prison reforms anybody. That's why I'm making the joke that the system worked and they reformed him, because he hasn't killed anybody since then.
Well, again, I think this comes down to the idea of whether someone could kill one time and not do it again, which I still firmly believe in, or whether this girl could get into a car at the highway and yet end up dead over at Lawson's Bush.
And I get that. I mean, you know, a gang member gets initiated and they take him on a drive-by shooting and he points the gun out the window and he shoots one person and he never does it again. I get that. But I think this crime was a little bit different and has a little bit more to do with somebody that's really screwed up. And he doesn't come off to me that way. So that's all I'm saying. But I understand why they found him guilty. And I don't even know if he deserved the money or not, but He's moved on, and if I was him, I probably would have moved on and just let it go. I wouldn't be trying to get it overturned or anything. I wouldn't care about a family name, but that's me. So and something else that I was going to bring up, but we didn't talk about the dogs.
The important thing to know here is we've gotten messages from people who say that the dogs were not good evidence, essentially. And the one thing that's been pointed out to me the most is that there was a case of a young girl who had gone missing, and they used these dogs to try and find if there was a body. And of course the cadaver dog found a spot, and I'm just going to say it. They have proof that the dog did hit upon cadaver. It's true. It just wasn't her, because she wasn't dead. They found her because her mother and her mother's boyfriend had hidden her away, hoping to get money out of sympathy. They were raising money and they had hidden her away. Well, the dog did find a body. It's not as you can't say that the dogs fail because they find cadaver scent that doesn't belong to the correct cadaver. And why don't you say it again, Justin? What did you say when we were talking about the McCann case and these dogs, Eddie and Keela?
As far as they're top dogs in their field, and they only hit upon the McCann's room and car and only items that belonged to this family. They did not hit on anything else at the hotel. And they were given lineups. They were walked around the entire resort and all the other rooms. They didn't hit on anything else. So if they were inconsistent, I would expect them to be inconsistent. But they only hit on their room, their keys, their shirts, their car.
Long story short, We believe the dogs. We not saying that it's necessarily concrete proof, but man, you talk about the greatest suspicion. Certainly.
And I watched a video of a dog walked out to acres of land, and they were trying to find the homeowner. And the person living at the house said the homeowner just gave him the house. And the dog walks out there, and he hits on a spot. They start digging. They find rotted meat and dead animals and other things. But the dog keeps hitting, even though they've removed the rotted meat and all this stuff. And so they bring in a backhoe, and that dog finds that cadaver 10 plus feet underground, not swayed by rotted meat and all the other things that the person had actually buried there to throw the dog off. It was a contractor that came to the guy's house to do stuff at the house, and he ended up killing the homeowner and burying him out in the backyard. But the backyard is huge. Huh?
And he just sort of slums there or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.